Hi, y'all. This is Kristen Chenoweth.
Hi, I'm Gloria Stefan.
This is Sarah Bareilles.
Hi, I'm Patti LuPone.
This is Lin-Manuel Miranda. You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Welcome to Stagecraft, Variety's theater podcast, bringing you backstage and behind the scenes with the Broadway stars, creators, and industry leaders keeping theater alive during the pandemic. I'm your host, Gordon Cox. On this episode of Stagecraft, I'm talking to Harvey Fierstein. He's a three-time Tony winner and longtime Broadway favorite. And although you can't see him on stage right now, he's bringing his latest play to your earbuds. Audible has just released the audio adaptation of Bella Bella, the solo biography of Bella Abzug that Fierstein wrote, and in which he stars as Bella herself. The play premiered at Manhattan Theater Club in the fall, but that already feels like a different era, and Abzug's life feels resonant to our own now in entirely new ways. Fierstein comes to Bella Bella after a career that launched with two early breakouts, Torch Song Trilogy and La Cage aux Folles, that became landmarks of gay representation in the theater. He's also no amateur when it comes to playing women, not after winning a Tony as Edna in Hairspray, and reprising the role in Hairspray Live on NBC. Along the way, he's had memorable parts in films like Mrs. Doubtfire, and worked on TV shows including, recently, The Dark Crystal, Age of Resistance. He's someone whose work and life were deeply engaged in an earlier epidemic and an ongoing fight for civil rights, and he's in the virtual studio with me to tell us what he's learned that's helping him through the current moment, and why Bella Abzug's fight for equity is just as important now as it was when she was alive.
Hi, Harvey. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Gordon. A little hole up there.
we're just gonna let the listeners guess what that subtext was.
This is life in the pandemic. It's people talking to each other, and nobody knows what anyone smells like.
Well, before we start, let's talk about first the origins of the show Bella Bella. Did you have a personal connection to Bella Abzug?
I met her. I met her several times. Yeah. She was, I'm happy to say, a fan. And the last time I saw her, it was Shirley MacLaine took her to my, the two of them came to my dressing room. I forget what show it was. But anyway, the two of us had a kind of riotous time in my dressing room together. And my favorite photograph with her, though, is me, Jesse Jackson, Bella, and Patti LaBelle.
Wow.
The four of us together. We were dating.
Yeah.
Jesse and I didn't want, we were like using the women as our beards.
Yeah.
But it was cool. Yeah, it was at a human rights campaign dinner. Patti was singing and Bella and me was there.
Yeah. And when did you first get the idea to write about her?
I never got the idea to write about her.
Okay.
Her daughter.
Oh, okay.
She came to me and said, "Harvey, I want you to write a musical about my parents." And I said, "Oh, did they have like a rocky marriage or something?" No, they had a very happy marriage. And like, did they break up? No, everything. So what do you want? You want two people to stand on the stage and go, "Bella, Bella, Martin, Martin." I didn't think it was going to work. So I said, "Leave me alone."
When was this? How long ago was this?
The 1920s.
Since
they locked me up in this room, it's very hard to put dates on anything. I don't know what day of the week it is. I don't know what year it is. It's very hard. I don't know. It was years ago.
Okay. Yeah.
Then when Hillary, but I did my due diligence. I read a whole bunch of stuff about Bella. I read a couple of books. I read her book, which was never published. She had proposed a autobiography, so I had a lot of notes from that. What I didn't realize at the time was that her friend Mim did all her writing. So she told stuff to Mim, but Mim was like the other Bella, and she did most of the writing. So the only stuff I actually had in her words were her speeches, of course, the ones that were off the cuff.
Right.
Otherwise, Mim wrote them. And these notes for an autobiography, which supposedly Bella wrote. So anyway, I read all that stuff and I put it away. I didn't see a musical Bella, Bella, Martin, Martin here.
Right.
Come the last election and Hillary lost. And I said, I think it was the Israel stuff. I think it was the Hillary is anti-Israel. Mm. And I said, I know she's not anti. I mean, she was Secretary of State. I mean, I know she's not. Where is this coming from? Who would make up some stuff? And I said, but it sounds awful familiar. And then I remembered, almost line for line, it was the same stuff they put out about Bella. And I realized it's the same boys club. And the boys club was out there coming up with the stuff, just targeting who the voters were and coming up with the stuff to get you not to vote for her. And I said, I'm going to go back and look at that Bella stuff again. So I did. I went back and I looked. And I called the daughters and I said, I kind of thinking about writing a piece. I don't know what the piece is. And they said, well, Julie Taymor is doing a movie with Bella's character in it. There's a TV series called Mrs. America.
Yeah, which is now out on Hulu. Yeah.
They're about to film that with the fabulous Martindale. Playing Bella. Bette Midler is going to be playing Bella for another movie. There's a documentary we're making. So all this stuff. So I said, who needs my view of this? But I kept thinking about something I had read in her stuff about the night that she lost the election. Mm-hmm. And I said, all of this could be what it's about. Right. I could get all this political stuff plus her history in that moment.
Right.
Because what happened was she was in Congress. She was very successful in Congress. As you know, she got a lot of stuff done.
Yeah.
But nobody wants to stay in Congress. I wish these people would stay in Congress. Look at all the mess they make. I'm dealing with Joe Kennedy III right now. What a mess. Stay in Congress. You don't have to go to the Senate. You stay. Anyway, so she wanted to go to the Senate. And I put in the arguments right into the play as to why she wanted to go to the Senate. But she wanted to go to the Senate. Her friends begged her not to. She wanted to. And then what happened was eventually she lost by less than 1% of the vote to Pat Moynihan, who was dragged into the race months after it should have been over.
Right.
They played so many dirty tricks on her, it wasn't even funny. And I thought, there has to be a moment. And the daughters, and when I asked the daughters about it, they said, oh yes, we were sitting in this hotel room, you know, until early in the morning. And I said, there had to be a moment when she finally realized she's going to lose, because she thought she was going to win. The whole time she thought she was going to win. And I thought, that's interesting. That's human. That's interesting. And so the idea for the play was born. So I wrote this play.
As a solo show. It was always a solo show as you were thinking about it?
Because it took place on that evening.
Yeah.
It was either do a solo show or have somebody play Gloria Steinem, somebody play Shirley MacLaine, somebody play Marlo. You know, there's too many famous people, and I didn't want to do the Peter Allen story.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. I didn't want somebody coming out as Liza and 5 minutes later they were Judy Garland. I mean, I didn't, you know, you don't want that. And so I wrote this as a locked in the bathroom, blah, blah, blah.
And at what point did you think about you playing Bella as well?
We did a couple of readings. We did a reading with Patti LuPone. Mm-hmm. A wonderful Patti did it for me. And then I kept thinking about all these other versions of Bella that would be out there. I love Margot. If I could get Margot to do the play today, I'd put it up again with Margot. I love her. I talked to Bette about it. I talked to several of the actresses, and I kept saying, they're already doing it. Why am I doing the same thing? Am I not doing something else? And then I thought, and then there were some people who said, you should do it yourself. And I said, to put on the wig and the hat and the dress, I would feel like I was dragging Bella. And
right.
And I thought, in this moment of Me Too, the idea of a man writing a woman's story and then putting those words in her mouth was so phony and so disingenuous, so much making a woman into a puppet, which is what we do in theater anyway. I mean, that is what we do. How could I, as a theater artist, I never looked to make money off the show, and I'll tell you what I actually wrote it for. We can get to that. But I, as a theater artist, what could I do to be more honest? And I said, if I just go out there and, well, oh wait, got to step back if this didn't happen yet. You see what happens? The brain just goes. My agent said, let's do a reading of the play and try and attract actors and actresses. And we had no director, we had no theater, we had no anything. So I said, okay, I'll read it. We went to CAA, which was up at the Chrysler Building. Now it's in everyone's basement. Yeah. But it once was up in a beautiful office in the Chrysler Building. And my agent stood up and said, hello, everybody, thank you for coming. We have no theater, we have no producer, we have no director, we have no actor. Here's Harvey reading the play. Maybe you got an idea. And I read the play. And out of that reading, I did get several offers, wonderful offers, Broadway, off-Broadway, off-off-Broadway. I got a couple of producers that said, you know, if I can get a star, I'll do blah, blah. But also out of that reading came something which was, if you do it yourself, there's something very honest about it. And that's when we had the discussion saying, if I do it and I don't do it in drag, and I just stand there and I say, I am bringing you Bella's words. I'm not dragging it up. I'm not putting any artifice on this. This right. is as honest as I can be. Let's see what could be. Right. We then decided that the room should be, I should be the only man in the room. I should be the only testosterone in the room. We needed, I wanted to be immersed in this. So I was not imitating Bella, but I was as close as I could get to understanding why and how, because she's a very particular human being, as you may know. I assume you heard the piece, or you saw the
yes, both those things, yeah.
So you know she's no one quite like Bella.
Right.
Very. I'm not saying she was right about anything or everything, but she definitely had a view. And so Kimberly Senior came in as director.
Director.
She's brilliant, brilliant woman, and I love her. We had only women stage managers and even assistants in the room, and our sound designer. We tried as hard as we could to make it a room of women. We then brought in Bella's friends, Lily Tomlin, Gloria Steinem, who was incredible help, and we created this room in which we could develop this Bella play, and then brought it out to the stage. And as you know, I just wore black pants, black shirt. Right. The only nod to femininity was my toenails.
Yeah.
And the hat.
And the big red hat. You couldn't do it without a big red hat, right?
Right. And that was made by her hat maker.
Oh,
but
wow.
I only wore it at the very end of the play. Put it on at the very last moment of the play. I carried it out at the beginning of the play.
Right.
And it was really interesting to see the reaction. It was really interesting. Yeah. Women almost, you know, because you get a lot of male when you're in a theater, like, oh, and then we decided to do it, you know, at MTC, where I had done Casa Valentina.
Right.
The public theater wanted it. There were several other theaters wanted it. But I wanted to do it as quickly as possible. The idea being, do the play. And as soon as the play is done, release the play to groups that want to put it on to raise money for women candidates. Further, her friends like Gloria or Shirley MacLaine or Marlo Thomas or Renee Taylor, I created a version of it that could be read, a concert version of it, so they could go to whatever woman running for office they wanted and use it as a fundraiser. Right. That was the idea for doing the play. Along comes COVID and that all goes down the toilet.
Right, yeah. And is the audible version then that concert version? That
the audible version is pretty much that concert version where you don't, though we use sound effects.
Uh-huh, right.
but you're not seeing anything. You're not. I mean, there's no toilet there. There's no whatever. So it is imagined. And, yeah. And so, yeah, so it is, I guess it pretty much is. I use the same script because, you know, I was doing what I was doing, and I'd already been there, done right. that. But what was most interesting was the audience reaction to it. Mm. Women went with it. 99.99% went with it. You know, once I'd been on stage for a couple of minutes, they sort of forgot that I was a man, and they just went with it. Some men had more problems with that, which I thought was interesting. I think my theory, they don't want to be told they're wrong. They don't want. It's fine if a woman does it. So if a woman stands there and makes fun of men and tells men they're idiots, they're already used to being told stuff by women and not listening. They don't care what women say. But having a man say it, you're a bunch of assholes and you don't know what you're doing, and this country's going down the toilet because of men, and the whole world would be better if men didn't run it. They really didn't like that. They really didn't like that. And I thought that was really funny because I said to myself, I've never seen anybody criticize Bella for saying that kind of stuff, but I've never heard those words come out of a man's mouth before. And that was my personal take on it. Now, obviously, most men that saw the show loved it, but there were men who really took offense at what the play was saying.
Yeah. And what, of course, it said it spoke very particularly to the time, you know, as you were doing it late last year, and now it feels like, as you've said, we're in an entirely different world where it feels like everything is different and time is shifting, and there are these, we're dealing with these sort of giant changes. We're sort of dealing with a pandemic, and then we're in the midst of this reckoning over, you know, justice for Black lives. And how do you find now, with the show coming out right now over Audible, how do you find the show speaks to this moment?
Well, the joke is that it actually speaks to this moment more than it's, I mean, it spoke to both moments,
right?
But people are more aware of it now. It might have been more shocking then, or you might have questioned, what is she talking about? Manipulating voters that way.
Right.
Now people actually understand, or they're beginning to understand, that you're being manipulated. You watch Donald, the King of Cheetos, stand there and do declare war. Just to get himself some good press, or to actually, it's not even to get himself good press. They're declaring war to get footage,
right,
so that they have TV ads to run. I mean, there's no reason. Hundreds of thousands, I don't know, millions of dollars being wasted, which no one's talking about. Millions of dollars being wasted bringing troops to Portland so he can get an ad to run for president. And no one's talking. They're saying, take away money from homeless people. Don't give unemployed people money, while he's taking millions of dollars and spending them to make ads. We have the military used as a prop. So in Bella, I talk about stuff like that. In Bella, we talk about using the war that way. And obviously you see the manipulations. In Bella, there's a large section that talks about her being the defense attorney for a man, right, who was accused of rape in Mississippi. What's sort of on a personal note, on one of those personal notes. So I wrote that section about the rape in Mississippi and the trial and all that, and it was incredibly hard to perform day after day. That section especially is very emotional. You know, to think, here's this woman who's 30 years old, sleeping in that bus station, unable to get a meal in town and all. And
right, because she was, for people who maybe haven't seen it recently, it's because she was defending a Black man.
She was defending a Black man. Nobody in the entire state would do it. And she went there and had her life threatened on a daily basis. And eventually they killed him. What's sort of funny is, we brought in students to the rehearsal room and had them watch the play. And because we knew we wanted to keep it to 90 minutes or under 90 minutes, and the play was 2 hours or more long. And so we wanted to see what registered with them, what didn't, what had to be explained more to kids, you know, and what didn't. And it's sort of funny, we cut out stuff that now I wish, you know, was still back in, that we took out stuff about we have Martin's death, and we have Martin Luther King's death and Bobby Kennedy's death in it. But we took out the Malcolm X stuff, which I think people would now understand more what she was talking about. These kids didn't know who Benny Shabazz was.
Oh,
yeah. They didn't know really who Malcolm X was. They knew who he was, but they didn't know why he was killed or how he was killed. Because Bella actually found a home for Betty Shabazz and her children after Malcolm X was killed. She sold her own home.
Wow.
She needed her to have a safe place to be. Hmm. And she sold her own home. When all of the neighbors threatened to sell their homes, the white flight. And she sold in her own home. So there was lots of stuff. I mean, I left in stuff about Sidney Poitier. I left in stuff. But there was a lot more of that stuff. And I just, it made me sad that cultural history is not taught. Right. That history is still taught by white people, written by white people. School books are still written by only white people. And you couldn't put that stuff on stage without standing there and explaining to. So that made me sad. But no, the play has lost none of its presence. In fact, it's more meaningful now than ever, I think.
I'll have more with Harvey right after the break.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
And now, here's more with Harvey Fierstein.
After your work,
you just heard it. Did it not ring?
Oh, it absolutely did. Yeah. I just wondered how you think about that. So actually, leads me into my next question: is okay. What now after?
Yeah, interview the interviewer.
Yeah,
learned that from Roy Cohn.
Yeah,
just kidding. Yikes, that's too dark, ugly.
After working on and studying Bella's legacy and thinking about all that, what have you come away admiring most about her work and her legacy?
That she was a Pollyanna. I mean, she faced such darkness. She faced darkness in her work. Against McCarthy and her work in social justice and racial divisions and her women's rights. And I mean, she did nothing but face uphill battles, most of which she lost. And she still was a fucking Pollyanna. She still, Harold Holzer said to me, can you put that song from Annie tomorrow in the show? Because that's who she was. And I said, I can't because it was written afterwards. But he said, that's really who she was. She really believed the sun will come out tomorrow. It will get better. And, so I admire that. She took her, she certainly took her knocks. And she was never down. And that's the other reason I wanted to write that moment and that last moment when she finally realizes that she's going to lose. And she says, I could walk out there and cry. She said, but I'm going out there with a smile on my face.
Yeah. And speaking of this moment we're all in, I feel like you're someone whose life and work has already been grappling with, or has grappled with in the past, if not a pandemic, then at least an epidemic with your work during the AIDS crisis. And certainly it's intersected with the fight for civil rights, with your ongoing commitment to gay causes. I just wonder if, well, let's start with the pandemic. How has your experience as an artist and an activist during the AIDS epidemic informed your view of what's going on right now with COVID?
I think very much. I think any of us who lived through the AIDS epidemic are not in as panicked a mode. We're more angry because we know that this is, we already know how this is passed on. Remember with AIDS, it took a long time.
Yeah.
It took a long time. And with AIDS, my anger is starting to come up, and I'm trying to keep it calm because look how calm I am. During the AIDS epidemic, you had people saying, I'm not going to that restaurant because those waiters could be gay and I could get AIDS. In this pandemic, where you can get it in a restaurant, they don't want to stay away.
Right.
Makes me fucking crazy.
Yeah.
You know how not to get this. It's very easy not to get this. And still, they're out there getting it. They're parties to go out and get it. Now, did we know of parties where people went out and got AIDS? Yes. Yes. I knew people. I knew one of my dearest friends wanted to die. His lover had died of AIDS. He didn't have AIDS. He wanted to die. That's all he wanted. And he went out and he fucked and he fucked and he fucked till he finally got sick, and then took him 7 or 8 years to die. I mean, such insanity. So you can't live through that and then look at this rather simple disease. Not this disease is not harmful. It's killed 145,000 people in America alone, and nobody cares. We got 4 million cases, and they act like it's the flu. It's just the flu. We now see evidence that children who are getting it, even though they're not symptomatic, are going to have permanent lung damage from it. Send them to school. It's fine. Send them to school. They don't even care about their own children. So how does living through AIDS, it keeps you a little calmer and it makes you not want to take out a machine gun.
What was done during the AIDS crisis that you feel like we could learn from right now?
Community. Oh, that's what I was going to say. We had no leadership. We had no leadership from the top, because they said to Ronald Reagan, we know this, the scientists said to Reagan, we have no way to cure this. We're not even sure what it is. We have no drugs for it. We have no way to cure it. Do not mention it. Don't mention it, because you will look like a loser because you can't take care of it. That was not the way to handle AIDS, and that's not the way to handle this. And so idiot Cheeto King is doing exactly that, saying, I'm not going to talk about this pandemic because I can't cure it. I can't do, all I can do is blame other people, which is all he ever did back in New York. I mean, those of us who actually know him, and I do know him, none of us would ever vote for him. Not a person, only people who never met him and somehow believe that crap would vote for him. But nobody who knows him would ever vote for him. And that's exactly what he did. He took a page out of Reagan's thing. If I can't have a good ending to this, I'm not even going to mention it. And that's going to cost hundreds of thousands of lives. But back then, our community jumped in. Now, the community seems to want to just go out and party instead and just ignore it.
Mm. And what about what's going on now with the uprisings and the movement for Black Lives? In what ways does your own experience as an activist sort of inform how you think about what's going on right now?
I came into teen years in the 60s, and I watched the civil rights movement, and I, you know, and the anti-war movement and all. Doesn't frighten me. I know that that's how you make change, and that's how you get the message across. I don't like it. Is there a pretty way to protest? I don't think we found it. You know, there's a nonviolence, it doesn't mean it's not going to be hurtful. It just means we don't create the violence. But if we're doing it right, the violence will get created against us. That's just the way it is. I think these moments come. I think they're incredibly important. Possibly the most important thing us white people can do is to shut the fuck up and listen and try and learn something. But that's really hard, especially if you want to help. You jump right in there and without understanding it. Just the theater argument alone is mind-boggling. August Wilson gave a speech once where he talked about putting black actors into white roles, saying that's not how it's done. It's not going to get us anywhere. One of the young men writing a piece for the Black Lives Matter movement said, black lives, black bodies and black lives are not the same thing. So I write a role, you know, of my mother or whatever, and I put a black woman in it. She's playing the role and that's wonderful. She's an actor. She should be able to, but it's not going to ever express. And the only way to express that is to have black writers. It's never really going to come from a well-meaning, white Jewish gay writer. It's going to come. I mean, I can write great black roles, hopefully, but the authenticity, the what needs to be say, what the roles with Spilkes have to come from the black experience, which means edumacation. It always comes back to edumacation.
Yeah. Does what's going on right now at all, has it influenced the way you think about some of your own work and sort of some of the work you've done in the past?
Well, we've had to grapple with it. We got a phone call asking about allowing productions of Hairspray, you know, all white productions of Hairspray or all Japanese.
Right.
Is the better example because we do have a Japanese producer.
Yeah.
I said, no, you can't. I said, but we've been doing it for years. Well, what you did for years, let's just start at this moment. You start with this moment.
Right.
If you can't tell me that you can put an actor on that stage who in real life, when he was walking down the street, people would cross the street to get away from that person that they immediately saw as a threat, then you can't do Hairspray.
Right.
Those yeah. kids were not put, the black kids were not put in that special ed class because they didn't read as well. They were put in that special ed class. I mean, it's a comedy, it's a musical comedy, right. But it's about something. It's about something very real. So we do have to face those kinds of things. Now, there are all kinds of moments. I mean, you live with these choice, you know, when you're doing something like theater, you live with these choices all the time. When I was offered Mulan, the wonderful Disney movie,
yeah,
I said no. I said you need to show me how many Asian actors are playing Asian roles before you come to a Caucasian actor and ask. I'm willing to do it. I would love to play an Asian role, but show me first. And they did. And when they showed me that there were enough Asian actors, I said, okay. You know, the leads were being played by Asian actors. I said, okay, I would do that. You have to think about this stuff if you're involved in the world. You just have to.
Yeah. And so how are you spending your days on a lighter topic? How's your pandemic going? What's happening?
I'm a hermit by nature. So my life has changed very little during the pandemic.
You were in Connecticut. Is that where you are?
Yeah, I live in Connecticut. Yeah. I've been here for 35 years. Very at home in my home. I'm a real nester.
Yeah.
And so my days haven't changed. I have my dog Zizzes, and I play with my dog Zizzes, and I have my dog play group. And so friends come over and all the dogs play together and we all visit, and I have my writing.
Yeah, what are you working on? That's my next question. Yeah,
I don't ever talk about what I'm working on.
Okay,
but let's put it this way: I have finished everything that was on my desk.
Oh,
so if theater ever comes back, we're ready to go.
Great,
I finished all my assignments, so they're all done, and they've all been turned in and everything else. And I am working on something new, but that's hither and thither. Yeah. And I make quilts. And usually I manage to make one quilt per winter if I'm home. And so I have all these friends who've been waiting for quilts for years. And I've been able since we've been in lockdown, I finished 7 quilts.
Yeah. That's not nothing. That's a lot of work.
A lot of freaking work. And I'm starting a new one this week. Yeah. So, and after this one, there's one more, and then I'm all paid off. And I've been eating. Look.
Yeah.
I mean, that's the horrible part. I mean, if somebody died, I don't know that I have a black suit I could wear. I think I'd have to take a page out of Alan Carr's playbook, put on a black muumuu, and go.
Yeah. Can you tell us anything about any of those finished shows that are sitting on your desk? Their plays, their musicals.
I can't tell you about that one.
It's quite all right.
I can't tell you about that one. My agent actually called me. CAA, God bless. we have rent to pay. They said, whatever happened to these other scripts, these sitcom scripts that I wrote like 10, 12 years ago. So they're just sitting there. So you want to like polish, want to do up and give us, let us see. And I go, fine.
Yeah,
I've handed those in. Casa Valentina, my play Casa Valentina was sold to Ryan Murphy, but I don't know if he's going to do it. So I'm waiting to hear, a final thing, if he's going to do it or not. And then there's another producer that wants to do it. So, make a film of it. That would be like one of those safe films to do, because it all takes place in one building.
Right.
So you could go get a house in the woods. It takes place in the Catskills. So you could get a house in the woods with a motel nearby, put everybody on lockdown, film it just in the, it could be a safe set. They're looking for things that are
like that. Yeah.
Yeah. That are safe. You asked what the difference was. Back in the AIDS days, I wrote safe sex. Right. Now I'm writing safe sets. That's the difference. Well, they shut it down. I was just about to leave for DC. I was doing, I was going to play Albert's mother in Bye Bye Birdie.
Oh.
I was going to play James.
That's right. That's right.
James,
yeah.
James Vanderbeek's mother in Bye Bye Birdie at the Kennedy Center. Oh. What else was about to happen? La Cage aux Folles was supposed to be done at City Center.
Yeah, that's right.
La Cage aux Folles was also being done at the Hollywood Bowl.
Right.
There was a whole mess of stuff. I'm happy to say Kinky Boots is just reopening in Korea.
Oh,
where they know how to handle,
where they can handle it.
Yeah. So, yeah, I have a friend who's conducting Phantom of the Opera. They were on lockdown for 3 weeks in their hotel room. Right. Can't imagine. I mean, they couldn't even go in the hallway. They weren't allowed on their balconies.
Wow.
For 3 weeks. They were just, it was TV, porn, and food dropped off at your door.
Yeah, and room service. Yeah, exactly.
Well, it wasn't even room service. He said the food arrived. You couldn't even order it from the hotel. Mm-hmm. Had to get it at once. Yeah.
Well,
all right, Gwen.
Well, it was great talking to you, Harvey. Thanks for your time. And we look forward to seeing you on stage as soon as we can.
Okay.
That was Harvey Fierstein, whose solo performance in his play Bella Bella is now available on Audible. If you like what you're hearing on this and other episodes of Stagecraft, we'd very much appreciate it if you took the time to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can subscribe and find past episodes there and on all the other pod places, including Spotify and on the Broadway Podcast Network, which is a great place to find more theater for your ears. I'll be back in 2 weeks with another new episode. In the meantime, find me on Twitter at @gcoxvariety. Thanks for listening, and see you soon.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at SuffsMusical.com.
If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.